These are interesting times in modern-day capitalism. I will tell you what. The most valuable company on the planet says it wants to contribute to the good of the country, and the biggest money manager in the world says, yeah, you better. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Wednesday today, the 17th of January. Good as always to have you along, everybody. To the list of companies crediting the new tax law for prompting them to make strategic business decisions, we can now add a certain device maker from Cupertino, California. Apple said today it is going to make, and this is a quote, a $350 billion contribution to the American economy over the next 5 years, bringing back overseas profits, a bunch of new jobs as well. We got Molly Wood, the host of Marketplace Tech, live on the phone to make me smart on this whole thing. Hey, Molly.
Hey, Kai.
So what is, to your mind, the biggest part of this announcement from Apple today?
You know, I am focusing on a minor detail, maybe, or a tiny detail in this story. What I think is very interesting is that Apple is, among all of the other things it said it's doing, building a new campus here, bringing 20,000 jobs, quintupling its investment in something called the Advanced Manufacturing Fund. This is a fund that Apple created in 2017, just in May. It invests in domestic manufacturers. It started this fund with $1 billion, which at the time, a lot of people said was, you know, a drop in the bucket, a marketing stunt, a way to sort of curry favor with the administration because Apple wasn't doing a lot of manufacturing here in the U.S. But now you have Apple saying, look, we're putting $5 billion into this fund, and we're going to try to create domestic jobs outside of Apple's own campuses, which I think is kind of interesting.
And it is exactly what the president has been talking about vis-a-vis Apple, which is you make all this stuff overseas. Why don't you you remember, he said, let's get them to make an iPhone in the States. That is, maybe they won't do that, but that's what this is all about.
Yeah, and I should be clear, that is still a very far cry from moving all the manufacturing to the United States. And I don't think we need to let Apple 100% off the hook for stashing 94% of its cash overseas for all of this time to avoid paying taxes. But that $5 billion into this fund is a significant amount of money.
Yeah. So the company is going to be, just to follow up on what you said, the company is going to bring back plus or minus $250 billion of overseas profits that it's had over there for a very long time. It's going to be 15.5%, contribute $40 billion to the treasury in taxes, and yet still wind up with a pile of money that it can invest in these 20,000 new jobs.
Yeah, well, and also I think we should say in potential acquisitions, I think it's a good time to start looking around at who Apple is going to buy. And that has been, you know, that's been something that I think shareholders have wondered for a long time. Stock buybacks are almost certain to be part of this. Yeah. But is this the moment where Apple comes back to the U.S. and buys Tesla, you know, says, look, we're done. It's certainly a possibility. People have speculated. It's a quick way to get into the car game, which is something that Apple's been looking at for a long time. I just think you might see some other big moves start to happen as a result of this giant influx into the old bank account.
We should call Elon Musk, see what he says. Molly Wood, the host of Marketplace Tech Live with us, explaining the big news today from Apple. Molly, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Kai.
All right, so this next item would seem to be self-evident, but it bears repeating from time to time. Elections do have consequences, you know, and here is today's business and economic reminder. The Consumer Financial Protection Bureau says it's going to revisit an Obama-era rule on payday lending. Specifically, had it gone into effect as scheduled, the rule would have required that payday lenders make sure the people they are lending money to could repay said money. As with many things in the realm of financial regulation, there were strong feelings on both sides, pro and con, when this rule was proposed. And Marketplace's Sabri Brenishore reports that the arguments are now erupting anew.
The CFPB's willingness to reconsider the payday lending rule has many consumer advocates disappointed.
It could end up being a terrible deal for consumers.
Rebecca Bornet is with the Center for Responsible Lending.
Payday loans are debt traps by design. Lenders charge nearly 400% APR on average. 75% of all payday loan fees are from borrowers who are trapped in more than 10 loans a year.
She says the idea that lenders should make sure borrowers won't get stuck in a cycle of debt is supported by nearly three quarters of Americans.
This is a baseline requirement that is fundamental to responsible lending practices.
Jamie Fulmer is with Advance America, which provides short-term, small-dollar loans. He says the government went too far with this rule.
This rule was over 1,700 pages long. It was a complicated series of arbitrary restrictions. You know, it created paperwork requirements that were more akin to a home mortgage than they were to a $200 loan.
He says the rule would have put 75% to 80% of the payday lending industry out of business. For borrowers, he says, even expensive loans are better than having to pay overdraft penalties or utility reconnect fees when they can't pay a bill.
Consumers deserve important consumer protections, but they also need to have the access to credit they need.
The CFPB spent nearly 5 years working on the original payday lending rule. The reconsideration is unlikely to take that long. The question for many is whether it will really be a reconsidering of the rule or a total undoing of it. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, well, here is the word I'm thinking of. You can supply your own. Melt up is where I'm going. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We told you yesterday about an interesting development in what you might call the world of socially responsible capitalism. Larry Fink, the CEO of BlackRock, it's a giant asset management company. They do pension funds and a whole bunch of what's called index investing. Larry Fink wrote an open letter to CEOs of some big companies in this economy, 1,000 of them plus or minus, telling them that he and the $6 trillion that he has under management, he wants them to think not just about making profits, but about making a positive contribution to society. That's a quote. We called him up to talk about it. Larry Fink, welcome to the program.
It's nice to be here.
You write CEO letters every year. Why this message this time?
Well, the message is it has been formed over many years, and I think each year we refine the message. The primary purpose of writing these letters is the investment world is changing and evolving. We're seeing trillions of dollars of money moving into index funds, and we're the largest index provider in the world in the form of the index funds and ETFs. We have to own every stock that is in an index, though. And so if you're an active investor, you could sell a company's shares if you decided that you don't like its future direction. But as an index provider, we must own everything that's in an index, good or bad. And so the only power we have as an investor representing all our shareholders is the power of our vote. So in the letter of this year, it's stylistically, it's different, and there's more and differentiated points. The key points that I wrote about this year is I think there's more pressure on public and private companies than ever before.
Okay, so you have given the 1,000 or so CEOs who got this letter, you've given them a little something of a talking to, right? This is fairly stern language coming from Larry Fink, right?
I would call it stern language.
It was fairly sober. I'll tell you that. I mean, you basically said we've got the power of our votes. We're going to be watching you, and you have to do better.
We want every leader of a company and his or her board to focus on the long term. And we are representing our shareholders who need long-term returns. And we believe long-term returns are economic. And the greatest way of getting great economic returns over a long horizon is thinking about those other points, too. It is not just making a profit and possibly doing things negative societally or to their employees or anything else. Okay. We believe companies need purpose.
Let me try to drill down a little bit into your motivations for sending this. Obviously, you've been in this game a long time. You understand what companies try to do and the role of companies in this society. I was struck, though, by this line. You say in this letter, we also see many governments failing to prepare for the future. Do I take you to mean that companies now have to step up where governments are failing?
I hope all companies will be stepping up and thinking about the long term. I think the realities are there are many governments who can't get out of its own way. They're focusing on short-termism. I believe companies who are focusing on the long-term issues that I presented in my letter, I think those companies will be stronger better, more profitable in the future.
Do you think capitalism needs to change? Is that fair?
I think capitalism is a function of society's needs. I don't think capitalism, just like technology, is static. I think it evolves and it changes. And I think capitalism, if it's static, it is not evolving with society. And I think capitalism has to evolve with society. And I do believe we're witnessing a time and place now where we are seeing the better companies more engaged. They're less focused on the quarterly return. They're focusing on the needs of their employees. They're focusing on how best to be better for their clients. And ultimately, if you're good for your employees and good for your clients, you're truly good for your shareholders. It generally all works together. In fact, when companies have high employee satisfaction, those company stocks perform very well. When companies have very low employee engagement and satisfaction, those companies generally perform very poorly.
You know, I was about to let you go, and I apologize for doing this, but I need to circle back to something, to the theme that has run through this conversation, and then I promise I'll let you get off the phone. You've talked a lot about the long term and how you want the companies in whom clients invest to be in it for the long term. But it does seem like you are spitting into the wind here, because there is no more industry or sector of this economy that is focused on the short term than Wall Street. Virtually by the minute, companies are tracking how they're doing and what's up. And I wonder if this task is not Sisyphean.
I left Wall Street a little over 30 years ago to form BlackRock. So we are...
But it hasn't changed much, right?
Well, I'm not part of Wall Street. We are a long-term investment manager who is trying to be as strong a fiduciary to our clients and to our shareholders as anyone. Wall Street is based on velocity of money.
Right.
And the velocity of money is it's no different than the media business. It's about clicks. Unfortunately, both.
Ouch.
That's why I think that's why the media and banking is so connected, because both businesses is based on clicks and the speed of information.
Larry Fink is the chairman, the founder, and the CEO of BlackRock. Mr. Fink, thanks very much for your time, sir. I do appreciate
it. Thank you. I enjoyed it.
I should tell you on the way out here, we did a whole series on that idea of shareholder value about a year and a half ago on this program, where corporate obligations actually do lie. It's called The Price of Profits. You can hear it at marketplace.org. Also, we've put the whole interview I did with Larry Fink. We talked, I don't know, 15, 20 minutes in a special episode of our Corner Office podcast out today. Check it out. For all the credit that President Trump takes for the performance of the American stock market over the past 15 or so months, and it's a lot, also credit for the falling unemployment rate in this country and rising figures for economic growth, there is a key point that has been lost in the shuffle: the rest of the global economy. Over the past year, economies and stock markets in Europe and China and Japan have been booming as well. Marketplace's Stephen Beard gives us the big picture from abroad.
You remember that quote, ask five economists a question and you'll get six different answers? Well, among the five that I consulted on this side of the pond, there was a striking level of agreement. Three of them poured scorn on President Trump's claiming credit for improvements in the US economy. Andrew Kenningham of Capital Economics, a consulting firm.
Generally speaking, the presidents have fairly limited impact on economic growth or unemployment rates, particularly over a short period of time.
So far, he claims, the biggest economic measure Trump has pushed through is the tax cuts, and that's only just been passed.
So I certainly don't think he can personally take much credit for the overall performance of the economy.
A view echoed by Michael Ben-Gad, professor of economics at City University.
In terms of the real economy, I don't think that there is any sign or any reason to believe that Trump's impact was positive.
There's a cyclical upswing underway, and it's global. Growth has been rising in Europe, China, and Japan, and their stock markets have boomed too. The rebound is largely propelled by rock-bottom interest rates. But what of the Trump bump, the big jump in the Dow since last November? Simon Tilford at the Tony Blair Institute for Global Change is dismissive.
I think we probably would have seen rising share values over the last year or so in the US, almost irrespective of who had won the election.
But the other two economists that I consulted here do believe that Trump has made a difference. Brian Davidson of Fathom Consulting says Trump's election triggered a big jump in consumer and business confidence, and that has had some effect on the real economy.
Some of the growth we've seen this year can be attributed to the prospect of tax cuts or the prospect of cutting regulations.
And Roger Farmer, professor of economics at Warwick University, goes even further. He says that just the prospect of lower taxes, less regulation, and more spending on infrastructure has fueled the rise in the US stock market over the past year.
There's a very strong influence of the stock market on the real economy. And to the extent that Mr. Trump had positive effects on the stock market, then yes, I would attribute the reduction in the unemployment and potentially faster growth to Mr. Trump.
But he says Trump's benign effect could go into reverse, depending on political developments.
If there's a big swing to the Democrats in the midterm elections that gives them the power and the strength to impeach the president, I would expect that to have a feedback effect in the same way that it did on the upside.
In other words, he says, there could be an almighty stock market crash hammering the real economy, both in the US and around the world. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Coming up.
They were all designed to essentially keep files from being collected by authorities.
Uber's maybe, sort of, kind of legal kill switch. But first, let's do the numbers. Don't know what happened with yesterday's surrender, but traders got it going today. The Dow Industrials gained 1.25%, 322 points, 26,115. Yes, a record. The NASDAQ up 1%, 74 points, 72.98 at the end. S&P 500 up 0.9%, 26 points, 28.02 there. Apple shares, since Molly and I talked about it, up 1.6% today. Early Facebook investor and board member Peter Thiel sold another $29 million worth of Facebook shares. That's on top of the $1 billion in Facebook stock he'd already unloaded. The sales were planned, we should say. Facebook shares off 0.4% today. Bond prices, why they fell, thanks for asking. Yield on the 10-year Treasury note rose to 2.57%. And you, yeah, you. You right there. You're listening to Facebook. You're listening to Marketplace. I blew the joke again.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Gusto. Let your employees know you've got their back by signing up for Gusto for payroll and HR. More than 300,000 small business owners use Gusto. They offer benefits like health insurance, employee onboarding, and more. Get your payroll taxes filed, deductions calculated, and your team paid fast. No more pain. Just the joy of running your business. Get 3 months free when you go to gusto.com/marketplace. That's gusto.com/marketplace.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. There are still officially three people missing in the mudslides in Montecito, California, of a week or so ago. Tons and more tons of mud and debris are still making travel in and out of Santa Barbara a challenge, to say the least. A solid stretch of Highway 101, the main north-south route in that area, is expected to stay closed at least through the weekend. And yet, people still have to get around, and they have to get to work. KQED's Stephen Cuevas spoke with commuters as they tried to figure things out.
It usually takes Mitchell Guzman about 40 minutes to get from Ventura to his job in Montecito. But today, with the area's main commuter lifeline, the 101 freeway, and other major roads damaged and swamped with muck, it'll take more than twice that by boat.
It's a beautiful morning here in the Santa Barbara Channel. Once again, welcome aboard.
A pair of whale-watching companies are running emergency commuter ferries between the Ventura and Santa Barbara harbors for workers, first responders, and medical personnel like Guzman at a cost of $32 per trip.
They didn't go to work at all last week.
It's his first day back at work as a full-time in-home caregiver. His wife, also a caregiver, has been looking after their elderly client in Montecito since the storm and landslides struck. She'll rotate out when Guzman arrives. On the upper deck of the ferry, Bill Pintard is talking about the latest news about the landslide.
This is my first day since the floods to go to Santa Barbara.
Yeah.
Because we can't get through.
He has friends and acquaintances who got hurt or perished in the storm or lost homes. Pinter lives on the edge of Montecito. He's headed to Santa Barbara for some business meetings, then to see a friend laid up in the hospital.
And he got washed down to Highway 101 in San Ysidro, and he broke his back. His father didn't survive. He survived. This whole thing is really sobering, and it's really hit every one of us to our very gut, to our very heart, and our soul.
The temporary commuter ferries aren't as packed as they were last week now that Amtrak's Pacific Surfliner is back in service. Amtrak is running extra trains along the Santa Barbara-Ventura coast at about half the cost of the sightseeing boats. And as it chugs slowly along the tracks through Montecito, you can spot crews from Caltrans and the Army Corps of Engineers still clearing mud, boulders, and tree limbs from a miles-long stretch of the 101 freeway. Officials hope to have the freeway reopened sometime next week. In Ventura, California, I'm Stephen Cuevas for Marketplace.
The past couple of years have not been the greatest of years for Uber. Scandal after PR disaster scandal unfolded, sexual harassment and a toxic workplace on the one hand, the behavior of founder and former CEO Travis Kalanick on the other. Both of those things were bad enough, but a whole lot of what the company was dealing with was its relationship with regulators, especially those in Canada and Europe. Olivia Zaleski wrote in Bloomberg about one solution that Uber came up with to handle its issues with law enforcement, a program, a computer program called Ripley, that let Uber employees in their San Francisco headquarters basically lock down company devices in any other office in the world. Olivia Zaleski, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
All right, so do me a favor and tell me how this Ripley thing worked, would you?
Well, let's imagine that you're in an Uber office abroad and you see the authorities, the tax authorities coming, and they're about to raid your office. You can see them through the window, or maybe security tips you off. As soon as you know that, let's say that you're the general manager of the office there, you press a button on your phone and it routes to Uber's headquarters in San Francisco. And there, a member of the security team initiates a program called Ripley that will shut down all the computers in your office abroad.
So that when the tax authorities or whoever it is finally show up and they look at your computer, what do they see?
A blank screen. They can't get in. And later iterations, they were able to get in, but they weren't able to access the files that they wanted. So there were a few iterations of this program, but they were all designed to essentially keep files from being collected by authorities that usually had warrants.
Okay, so why then did Uber feel it was necessary to install this sort of remote shutdown thing?
Well, from their perspective, they feel that they were targeted. They also feel that in certain countries that they operated in, there was a corrupt taxi authority that would influence labor oversight. And they felt that they were being unfairly targeted and that they had a right to withhold information from these groups. And then they also felt that it was their job to protect their customer data, which, you know, some of these warrants they felt were too broad. They were like fishing expeditions, and there was important customer data that they didn't want to share, and they didn't want it to get into the hands of the wrong people like their competitors.
This goes back to an event in Brussels in 2015, right? Explain that whole thing to us.
Yeah, the 2015 raid in Brussels was really when Uber realized, you know, that we have a problem on our hands. We're getting targeted by authorities. They don't like us, and we need to design something that will make it impossible for authorities to collect information on us when they come into our offices. So that's what initiated the program. And after that, they designed Ripley.
Is this legal? Are they allowed to do this?
So it's interesting. We've spoken to a lot of lawyers and we've gotten a lot of answers, which end up being pretty much the same thing, which is no lawyer feels comfortable commenting on the legality of this program without seeing the actual warrants and really getting into the paperwork and nitty gritty. But overall, every lawyer we spoke with said it doesn't look good.
Let me ask a clarifying question here. This, it's to me anyway, a layman on the outside, it looks more like they were working toward delaying law enforcement than they were in protecting user information. Does that make sense?
I think that's accurate. That's the understanding that we got from our sources, is that everything from this program to how they would position their security guards or the way they would design their offices was made in an effort to kind of hamper the investigation to give them more time.
Right. Is this still active? Are they still doing this?
they are not using Ripley anymore. They're using a different program now called U-Locker, which is not that different from, say, your phone is lost and you need to wipe your phone remotely. And that's really designed for if an Uber laptop gets stolen by, say, a competitor or somebody else, they can remotely disable it. But as far as I know, they're not getting raided anymore and they're not using the sort of kill switch button that they were using previously.
Olivia Zaleski at Bloomberg, thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me.
This final note on the way out today in which, told you so, Bitcoin fell another 12% today, down under $10,000 per cryptocurrency. Yes, still an astronomical percentage gain over the past 3 months or so, but one Bitcoin is now worth basically half of what it was at New Year's. Far be it for me to say cryptocurrencies are in a bubble, but there is a cryptocurrency out there called DentaCoin. It's supposed to be a payment system for global dentistry. It's got a market value of $804 million. I mean, I really like my dentist a lot, but right? Dow up 1.25% today, 322 points. NASDAQ up 1%, 74 points. S&P 500, 0.9% to the good, 26 points. Sarah Bruguer, Jake Gorski, Drew Jostad, Jeff Peters, Dan Powell, Daniel Ramirez, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Tolliday engineer the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.